Hello, thank you for joining us for what should be a great game.
The fourth official couldn't allow him on because the fourth official never had the sheep.
Well, he never heated up the baby, did he? Unless he's breastfeeding, he should be all right.
Welcome to the Football Family, the 42's dedicated football podcast. The bank holiday weekend has led us back to all pastures on this Tuesday morning, this manky Tuesday morning. I am your host, David Sneyd, and joining me once again is Shane Keegan, along with the returning Gavin Cooney. Good morning, lads.
What's the crack, Dave?
How are we?
I'm very well. I had got about six more paragraphs of a well-cultivated intro, but then I saw the photo or the photo frame behind your back, Shane. Not only Gavin's Masters, 2023 Masters flag, but the photo frame behind you, Shane, has us all captivated. Please explain to the listeners and hopefully to the watchers.
Shamefully, it wasn't even up on the wall for a long time, so it wasn't due to my complete lack of DIY skills. Like, I genuinely couldn't even hang a frame. Like, that's the truth. I'm atrocious in that area. But yeah, since I did hang it up, I think I have been broadcasting from work every day. That's the reason it hasn't appeared in the background of one of our podcasts yet. But yeah, there is quite... So to explain what we've got, it's a Diego Maradona frame with a signed jersey and a picture of Diego as well. And the backstory is quite funny around it, to be honest with you. So my first ever proper jersey was the Argentina jersey for 1986 World Cup with Maradona 10 on the back. I was four at the time, and my mother would be, a sentimental sort of a creature, you know, and she would always, she would always associate Maradona with, oh, Shane, when he was a child and blah, blah, blah. But she went off to one of these charity work auctions, silent auctions, you know, these yokes. And basically it was, I don't know what it was for or something, or anyway, raise money for something or other anyway. And so what they do with these things is they plough you with a heap of fucking wine first, so that you're scutter drunk when it comes to the bidding process.
Like any good dinner dance.
There you are. There you are. So yeah, basically she presented me with this for, I think it was our wedding. I think when me and Roisin were getting married, I think she gave me this as my wedding present, and told me that she had attended a charity auction, a silent auction, and had made a bid, and her bid had won, and that she wasn't going to tell me how much it cost, but that I was to immediately put it on the house insurance.
That right.
so yeah, my drunk and emotional mother paid way over the odds, I'd say. But look, she bought it. I have it a long time, as I said. We're married 10 years now, so I had it when Diego was still alive, so I'd say it probably genuinely has shot up in value, all right. But it's a nice one, isn't it?
I'm picturing, I don't know if you watch Friends, but not the episode where like Joey goes to an auction but doesn't know what an auction is, and he thinks he has to guess.
guess the value.
I know, but that's quality. What is the actual jersey? I'm trying to think. Is the picture? It looks as if, is that the picture from the 86 World Cup as well? It looks like it is.
It is. I'll tell you.
Looks like the Belgium details. Game.
Yeah, Belgium. Yeah.
No, Hungary. Hungry.
Oh, Hungary.
So the details on it are Diego Maradona, date of birth, the whole lot, yeah. And then it says, sorry. International debut, 27th, 1977 v. Hungary. Sorry, so that's just saying that that was when he made his debut. Yeah, you could be right on who they're playing. Not 100% sure.
So if Leeds GAA runs into financial difficulties, is this going to be helping the bailout?
Hold on now, you're after bringing it up, so I'm just going to have to tilt the camera in the other direction. Oh. And there is the other framed photo, which is the only Laois team to ever win an All-Ireland, 1915 Laois hurling team, with my great-grandfather front and centre.
Very good.
Mainstay of that team. Oh, bit of boat on the wall.
It's impressive stuff, like.
Yeah, if ever two walls summed you up, I think that is it. No, genuinely, it's really cool. I see Gav has the 2023 Masters flag from when you...
The story behind my...
That sums him up.
The story behind the Masters flag on display is not interesting or that impressive at all. I had a Zoom interview on Sunday with Tom McKibben, the golfer, and I thought, fuck it, well, I put this flag up in the background and it might take me a bit more seriously. So I put it up and... Was it the greatest interview I've ever done? Probably not. Did he take me more seriously as a result? I have no idea.
Have you got any other? In fairness, I'm trying to think. Memorabilia. I've got loads of fanzines and stuff. I have got a signed jersey downstairs that is in my downstairs bathroom that I've been allowed to have up. I don't actually want to reveal exactly what is on it because I probably wouldn't come across very well.
Intrigued now.
But it was signed. Yeah, yeah. Well, if you know what football team we support, and it's interesting. But now, I'm thrown here now slightly just by that because they genuinely got married on a thing. That also reminds me, I'm going off on a slight bit of a digression here. I remember my dad telling me, my dad went with a lot of lads where he's from in town to the 86 World Cup following, I was 86 or 82 when Northern Ireland, which one were Northern Ireland at?
82.
82, wasn't it? Yeah, it would have been because you would have been younger, 82. Yeah, because I was born in 88. My dad was held against me because he couldn't go to Euro 88 because my mum was due. I was born the following month. Couldn't go to Italian 90 because my sister was born. Obviously, my dad went, but he went in 82 with all the lads from town. But he was saying that he got a hat belonging to Zico, but my nana threw it away when she was clearing out the attic, clearing out the house. Yeah. That's the kind of the closest I have to any kind of memorabilia that's on a par with Maradona.
Might have been a Zico international cap. Might have been really worth something to Zico, first of all, as opposed to everyone else.
No, I think he made it out as if it was one of those bucket hats, some of those types, you know, because I guess I can imagine he's going to wear one.
Well, you two fuckers obviously weren't even born, I'd say, for the 1986 World Cup. But I do have, like, even though I was four, I can, you know, that is definitely my earliest soccer football memory is Maradona at 86. It's unfortunately closely followed by me remembering our 1987 FA Cup final defeat to Coventry City with Spurs. But they are the two earliest football memories that I have. They all stick out.
And in fairness, is Gav's hoodie a very similar colour to the jersey that Coventry wore? Did Coventry not have some manky brown kit back then? Didn't they?
This is maroon.
Maroon, sorry.
Your hoodie is manky brown now. That's the official.
I say that with love, Gavin. You know, listen, I am in no position to be slagging anybody's slagging.
Oh, well, I know in that game they're definitely wearing their more traditional blue and white stripes in that game. Whatever about this manky brown kit that they had, but our main man Ronan in the background there, I'm sure will remember it very, very well. Gary Mabbott, 96th minute OG.
But you like that blue and white kit.
So one good early memory.
You like that
bad.
Blue and white kit so much you got Diego Maradona to sign a jersey.
Nice.
Have you got it appraised? I know we're staying on this, but like, have you got it appraised?
No, I haven't done yet. Like I said, I'd imagine it shot up on the back of Diego's passing, all right. But I'd nearly be afraid to because... Sure, it's not the kind of thing you ever want to cash in on, really, is it?
No.
Definitely not.
Welcome back, Gav.
Thanks very much, yeah. Great to be back, yeah. I went away hoping that the FAI would do the whole international manager business and get it all sorted and I wouldn't have to do any work on it. back we've come and seemingly nothing has really moved on, which is a bit disappointing. But now it's good to be back.
Do you know what? And it is, and it's good to have you back. But it's like, because obviously we get to have this conversation with you now, and because the new manager hasn't actually been appointed. But you're saying there it's disappointing. I only feel it's disappointing because the FAI were the ones themselves, and Jonathan Hill were the ones who actually said they wanted to have the manager in place by the time the draw was made for the Nations League, which is on Thursday. That's the only reason why I know, obviously, in the back, but that's no, I don't think if they had to say, listen, let's be honest, because I was writing about this as well, while you were off, like, a lot of stuff has been happening over the last little while, so I don't think anybody would have been like, well, do you know what? I think it's understandable that maybe the search hasn't happened. It's only because they had this day fixed in their own heads that and made it public that they wanted to actually have it done by.
Yeah, and look, I can understand the reasons for wanting to have it from the draw, because then as soon as you know the draw, you know your opponents and, you know, you have maximum amount of time to start planning and so forth. But I didn't really see the rush in that. I know it's felt like a slightly arbitrary deadline for me. I think the time to have them in is a few weeks before even by the start of March, I think it's probably time enough. Maybe you wanted slightly early in February just to start prepping for those games in March, the friendly matches and getting backroom staff and getting everything lined up and so forth. But if it means waiting a week or two to see if the FAI can push Carsley over the line and get their top choice, I don't think anyone can really have a complaint about that. And I've read, there are some grumblings about the FAI's process around this, and are they making a bit of a meal of it? And to be honest, I'm kind of uncomfortable going there because I genuinely don't know enough about the process, because those involved are keeping it pretty tightly under wraps. And look, if they end up getting Carsley at the end of it, then if it took another couple of weeks, why matter? Like, I think it's pretty obvious now that he's been the prime candidate and the guy that they want. And if they can get him over the line, then it's worth a couple of weeks. But it's if that doesn't happen, and then they're scrambling around for second, third, fourth choice, have they put themselves on the back foot by leaving it this long? Maybe then you're into the realm of where you can criticize them and so forth. But I'm not as exercised about the delay and so forth as some people are.
Well, surely just all the excitement and the glamour and the glitz around Thursday's draw will surely want to maybe get a manager involved and say, you know what, this is me. I fancy a bit of this.
Yeah, so the Nations League is back. Draw is happening 5 o'clock Irish time in Paris on Thursday. I was just doing a piece for the site today that will run on Thursday, just looking ahead to the draw. Like, we could, again, get a really difficult draw, and Ireland are in pot three in League B, which is where we've been since the start of this bloody thing. We've been circling the drain. We should have got relegated in the first campaign under Martin O'Neill, but they changed the format to 4-team groups and gave us a stay of execution. And that's meant in the previous two campaigns, there's always been someone slightly worse than us from pot four who's got relegated on the final day instead of us. So that was Bulgaria, and then it was Armenia. But if you look at the draw this time around of the pots, I'm not sure. Like, pot four, who's in there? Greece are in there, Kazakhstan are in there, Turkey are in there, and Georgia are in there. We know the Greece are better than us. Turkey are ranked, 37th in the world, topped their qualifying group for the Euros ahead of Croatia. So that leaves Kazakhstan or Georgia. Kazakhstan is a pretty arduous trip, and you say they're the easiest of the draws, but they still finished well ahead of Northern Ireland in their Euros qualifier, finished level on points with Finland, and then Georgia keep getting better every time we play them, and this time they've got Kvaratskhelia. So obviously then you're looking in pot one, Wales, no one really wants to get Wales, I don't think, because we're so sick of playing them, but they look the best option out of Czech Republic, Austria and England are there. Like, it'd be interesting and fascinating, etc., if we drew them, but we don't have a hope in hell of beating them or finishing ahead of them. And then pot two, you're looking at one of Finland, Ukraine, Norway, and Iceland. So I think Iceland are the team to get there. Norway are not the sum of their parts, but those individual parts are still pretty damn good and better than anything we have. Ukraine, we saw how we struggled with them in the last Nations League. Finland, I think, are beatable as well. So it's a really difficult draw for us. It'll be a difficult draw, I think, regardless, for Ireland on Thursday. And the Nations League is it's a bit like taxation in the sense that it's really complicated. No one really explains it fully to you, but you just know it's important for some strange reason. And it's going to be like that again. Like, Ireland, they'll have to finish in the top two of their qualifying group for the World Cup to get a playoff. That's by no means guaranteed. So the four Nations League group winners who don't do that will get a playoff as well. But to get a playoff, that means Ireland will have to top their group, which looks fairly unlikely. Even, it's early for forecasts. We haven't seen the draw and we don't have a manager yet. But I just think that the Thursday's draw, when the teams come out of the hat, will it make Lee Carsley even more eager to take the Ireland job? I'm not so sure.
might make FAI change course. Might need a completely different type of manager.
Maybe. I don't know.
I say that flippantly, but it's how you played it out there. It just kind of paints. It shows you. It goes. Remember, Stephen Kenny was saying he wanted to win the group, but obviously that didn't materialise last time. But just kind of you've laid it out there in terms of just where Ireland are really at now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think. Look, I don't know. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic, too far ahead of time. I just think if Ireland don't get relegated from this League B, it's going to be a reasonable success. I think that's more optimistic than certainly top in the group. The one thing about it is that, the Nations League, every time we play it, there seems to be more games, and that's the case again. So if Ireland finished third in the group this time, they'll have a promotion relegation playoff against a League C team, the team that finishes second there, and where they finish second in their group, play a promotion playoff against a team that finished third in League A, if that makes sense. So it's in Ireland's interest to finish as best they can, because obviously the last Nations League campaign going awry meant we were third seeds for the Euros draw and ended up with France and with the Netherlands. So obviously, like, every game is important, but you know, as a starting campaign for a new manager, it's not going to be easy.
The way you've explained it there, Gav, then, it, like, realistically, in terms of our potential outcomes, the most important team is who's the most important thing is who's the weakest team in our group. Like, it doesn't really matter who's first and second, because we're not really going to be able to compete with them anyway, really, are we? So it's all about who the weak team drawn in our group.
I think we could maybe compete with Wales. You know, I mean, they're kind of they are on the slide a bit, and Czech Republic are not.
Iceland are struggling as well.
Are no world beaters. See, that's the ironic thing is, because the draw is done on seedings from the Nations League rather than world rankings, it means like teams are kind of kept artificially high because they've been coming down from League A, and some teams are artificially low because they've been promoted. So like Turkey are in pot four, are something like 37th in the FIFA rankings. Iceland are in the 70s in the world rankings, but are in pot two. So the ironic thing is, I think when we see the draw, it might well be the case that the team that Ireland draw out of the second pot are eminently more beatable than the team that come out of the fourth pot, if you know what I mean. But the only thing is that, you know, you look at Kazakhstan might be the team to draw in pot four. They're ranked 100th in the world. Because the distance to travel is so far, they can only be drawn against one of ourselves, England, Wales or Iceland. So if we want either Wales or Iceland from pot one or two, we can't get Kazakhstan, which kind of makes it a little bit trickier again, I think.
I didn't know distances would be factored in like that. That's a bit of a mad one, all right. So it is like, yeah. I mean, from an excitement point of view, entertainment point of view, like competitive games against England and Norway would certainly be the ones that would pique my interest there anyway.
Well, it could be the Lee Carsey Derby, couldn't it, against England and Norway. We saw, well, look, I mean, a Haalandless Norway came to Dublin just before the World Cup and beat us anyway. So, I mean, they probably beat us with Haaland and the team as well. I'd be very pessimistic here. Maybe it's the weather. but
I know. That's why I'm wearing a jacket inside. It's just that bad. But you know what? I know, Shane, we discussed this last week and we were chatting about it. And you can't not, because obviously the manager hasn't been confirmed yet. But it kind of feels as if the appointment of who they go with is going to actually determine a lot of the thinking and a lot of the feel around where Ireland are at. Do you know what I mean? So the draw is made. But like, if they go for a certain manager, I think Lee Carsey would probably be the one that would more so excite a lot of people, purely because there's still an element of the unknown about it, even though he's done well and obviously winning under-21s. Whereas if they go with what seems to be the other option, which is Neil Lennon, that's just going to be giving people a bit of a downer. Like, if it does sense that everything's tied into the manager appointment of to where how people are feeling about the Ireland national team.
Yeah, 100%. And look, to echo what Gav said, you know, you feel like a drawn out process will have been worth, you know, waiting through, in my opinion, if it does end up being Lee Carsley. If it's not Lee Carsley, I just still can't wrap my head around how the best we could come up with outside of that is Neil Lennon. I just don't think they've been anywhere near imaginative enough in this process. Like, there's got to be, you know, managers from outside of the box. Might require bringing them across from far flung parts of the world, but like, I'd love to see us going after somebody who we're going, look, I know it's still a gamble, but somebody who we're thinking this person has, or the FAI believe this person has the potential to be the next big thing, rather than going after something that, let's be honest, is very, very, like, if don't get me wrong, like, obviously if a massive Celtic fan, if Neil Lennon got the job, I really, really hope that he kind of puts me in place and it does turn out to be a fantastic year under him. But it is hard to get excited about it. Like, there's you'd be lying if you said otherwise.
Because I'd be shocked if it's Lennon now at this point. I kind of think that, I don't know, maybe everyone is okay with him, FAI and him are okay with him being like an obvious second choice or further down the list. But I also kind of think that there was that board meeting last Tuesday that people huddled around hoping for news, and you know, if it was going to be Lennon, I kind of think he would have been appointed by then. And there's been kind of negative, like pretty kind of headlines in newspapers digging up issues from his past and so forth. It's not good PR for an association that are very, very concerned with that kind of thing. So, and just the fact that Lennon's name is out there makes me think that maybe they're worried about, or that maybe they're eager to see how his name might be received. So could be wrong. These things can always change and so forth. But
So if Carsley doesn't accept the role, who is it now then, Gav?
Well, I think it's going to have to be Roy Keane, to be honest, Shane. I think we're all dancing around it. Like, we're not going to get...
Well, I was going to ask you on the Keane point, but let's just go with your... I discussed this with Shane last week about the profile of person and manager that I would have thought would get the job. So what's your in terms of your best LinkedIn kind of spiel here, what would you be looking at here, Gavin? Oh, do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of, like, we've both been doing, we've all been watching Ireland over the last number of years, but like, you've obviously been on the beat in terms of home and away. This group of players, of where they're at, the profile of manager, the person that is coming in, what do you think should be the priority for the FAI?
The most obvious one is one that gets results, because the results weren't good enough under Stephen Kenny. And then after that, like, I mean, how do you get results? I think you have to be pretty adaptable. I think the lesson that we've learned from international football, especially over the last few years, that like the ideologues are at club football and the improvisers are at international football. Like, you can say Lionel Scaloni had Lionel Messi and 10 other great players on the pitch at all times at the World Cup, but he still, you know, he had a whole system of play and a formation, etc., going into the World Cup. They'd been unbeaten for 30 odd games, lose 2-0 to Saudi Arabia, and it's all blowing up, and he manages to change it on the fly. I think he had different formations in every single knockout game at the World Cup. So that kind of level of improvisation is quite important at international level, and you need a guy who'll come in and play to the strengths of the players that he's got. And that's not, you know, the kind of people out there are worried that now post Stephen Kenny, you'll end up with, Sam Allardyce a cheaper Sam Allardyce. You can't even fucking afford Sam Allardyce to go along. But like, that doesn't really suit the players that are available, really, does it? I mean, you'd think that, our front two of Ida and Ferguson, they're the kind of, you know, the most physically imposing and most athletic strike partnership we have. But we played them up front away to Greece, knocked it long to them, and it was a disaster, you know. So we can't really play that way. So I think a manager has got to come in to who acknowledges that he has to find a way of playing that suits his players and can improvise and adapt as necessary. And the other thing he has to do is kind of get the fans on side and like make people feel good about the team, because no one's really feeling good about the team anymore. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I was so pessimistic in that whole Nations League chat. Maybe a new manager comes in and everyone feels completely different about that draw, regardless of who we get. And I think that's what's exciting about Carsley, is that we don't know what he'll be kind of like. You know, I mean, Lennon, we just know too much in Neil Lennon, I think. We've seen too many of his teams, and it's all a little bit uninspiring, and nothing he has said in the press would be particularly inspire you either as regards how he wants to play and so forth. With Carsley, who knows, it might never work out. There's still massive questions about him. He's never held a managerial job of this stature before. I don't think he's really had a permanent first team manager's role. He's done, you know, lots of stints as caretaker and so forth, and maybe there's an impression out there that maybe he's avoided taking some of those roles in the past, but it would still be a risk as regards that. And to be honest, in all fairness, Keane may not fit many of the boxes previously I've explained, but he would definitely, I think he would generally excite people.
And thing as well, the Carsley's only a couple of years younger than Neil Lennon. People like, maybe think that there's a huge difference. Like Carsley's going to be 50 this month.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There is that element. Like,
which is interesting when you look at from if Carsley's kind of unsure about the job, which seems to be like that's been a constant reoccurring thing over the past while, that is he kind of interested, is he not? Maybe this whole thing is kind of hardball negotiating tactics, and if it is, best looks, Carsley seems to be doing a pretty good job of it. But, you know, like this Ireland job, it's a 4-year gig at the minimum. Like, I mean, the manager will rightly get through to Euro 2028, and as host will probably be at that tournament, and that, you know, that takes him into his 50s and will be a similar age profile to Stephen Kenny is now, you know. And, you know, the other thing to look out for is that Ireland, the Irish job, has not traditionally been a springboard to greater things. Like, I mean, think back to when was the last time an Ireland manager went on to do something notable elsewhere in the game? Mick McCarthy after his first stint probably is the exception that proves the rule. Now, this is partly due to the age of candidates we've been recruiting, which looks like it might change now, but I can understand if that all that is playing into his reticence.
But I wonder as well, Shane, even where, if you look at the profile, Gal made that point there, say the ideologues at club level and maybe improvisers more so need at international level. And I kind of laid it out last week. I mean, I don't know, like, what does the team need, you reckon? Is it someone, a coach who is going along with them and learning a little bit and is maybe more in tune with them at younger, or an older hand who can actually guide them? Because one of the things that definitely stood out over the last little while is with Ireland is just a little bit of the kind of the brittleness about them, and not that kind of hard edge nature in certain games to see off in certain moments.
Yeah, look, like, the point here is you can make a perfectly plausible argument for either of those two being the priority. Like, you know, again, Carnsley probably falls into the we're not quite 100% sure what we're going to get here, but we think he has the potential to be very good. And that one is, you know, that is probably the more exciting bracket. It's also the one, it's probably the one with the higher ceiling, but the lower floor, if that makes sense, in terms of how it could potentially go. Out, if it's not him in that bracket, who is it? Like, because I am at the, you know, I'm kind of constantly looking at, right, we're all going to assume it is him, but if it's not, well, what's left? And I don't know who else could fall into that bracket. There's obviously, look, there's been kind of a bit of Damien Duff talk, maybe. when you put Keane in the group earlier today, I genuinely didn't know whether we were going to be talking about Roy Keane or Robbie Keane. So Robbie technically still falls in that bracket. I have always kind of made the argument that if we're considering Damien Duff, I'm not 100% sure why we're not considering Stephen Bradley. But look, he's probably, and he's just unfortunate in that who the predecessor is. I don't think we're going to go that route again so quickly. And then there is the argument for going the complete opposite direction. But if we're going the opposite direction, in other words, a proven, you know, manager who has managed a lot of games in their career so far, I just really still think that surely we can do better in that category than Neil Lennon or Steve Bruce or some of the other names that, like, again, you know, I realize I'm giving out here without throwing out any suggestions, but like, maybe this is an utterly ridiculous thing to say, but like, is it not our turn by now to have a go off Gus Hiddink? No, everybody else has had a go off Gus Hiddink surely by this stage. It must be our turn by now to have a Gus Hiddink in charge, surely.
Just have to Google him to see where he is. Is he at Chelsea or so? Is he at South Korea? Where is he?
I don't think he's anywhere. He was with, like, who the hell are Krakow? Gav, fill me in. You're the one with brains in this.
I don't know how to. It's the Caribbean nation of. Is it Curacao? Is that how you say it? I actually genuinely don't know how to say it. Yeah,
and that was his most recent gig, to the best of my knowledge. Like, yeah. Previous to that was the China under 21s.
Yeah, like, he's worked in some interesting places. Obviously, extensive history in Russia and
Russia, Australia, Turkey, South Korea. He's had some amount of international sites. Like,
can I just say, a 77-year-old Gus Hiddink, not the direction we should be traveling.
Well, yeah. Well, I think at that point you might have to get yourself the tattoo removed. Booked in for. We've laid out a lot of reasons of some of the struggles, and like, I'm now actually dreading this Nations League draw on Thursday. I've never felt so despondent going into any type of draw. But there is one major positive over the last little while, and that's Chidozie Ogbeni. Jamie Carragher was certainly enthralled as he laid out on Monday Night Football.
Listen, the reason I'm laughing is because I've been there. And the way Dan Byrne feels at the moment, having chased this fella at the weekends, the way I used to feel chasing Thierry Henry. And as I said, he's in that wing-back role. We get it now. And the thing I look at, you know when you're playing against a quick player as a defender, because you don't even look at the ball. You just get on your bike and you go and you run and you hope that ball isn't a great ball in behind you. And look at that pace.
He's not even going.
That's devastating,
he's not even
isn't
actually
it?
Really going. He was holding some back there.
Cruising,
as well.
Yeah.
He was cruising.
But this is another one situation where he's actually picks the ball up deep and runs with it, the ball at his feet.
Newcastle. And try and get back into your position as much as you can.
Well, we've seen on the first one, Dan Byrne actually sort of let him run past him. He fouls outside the box initially, but if it continues into the box, we know that is then a penalty. And listen, that's one where he's just got to let him go. They go on to score the penalty. But you know what I think about Luton players who've really impressed me? He's the one. Him alongside Ross Barkley being fantastic. And this might make Dan Byrne feel a little bit better in that we are looking at a guy who's the second fastest player recorded speed in the Premier League this season.
This is top speed that they've clocked. Mickey van der Ven just nudged above him.
It's interesting that like Carragher's picking him out from a position of playing right wing back, whereas with Ireland, Stephen Kenny was pretty adamant that he didn't see him there. He wanted him. Now that was obviously part of the reason of Seamus Coleman, Matt Doherty, Saul Moore as an attacker. But do we have to now, I don't know, think differently about Chidozie Egbene, Shane?
Yeah, I think so, to be honest. I think he's really flourished over the last couple of games in that position. Now, again, not to go back to the previous conversation, but does the position of right wing back even exist in whoever the new manager's formation is going to be? I mean, right wing back only exists if you're playing with three centre halves. And then the question becomes, if it is, you know, more of a traditional, you know, 4-2-3-1 or whatever it is he up? Well, sure, he can't be up front because Evan has to be centre forward. So in that scenario, he probably is right wing, which is probably more more common to him. But I thought Carragher's clips there, as we've heard, I thought the excerpt was excellent. It was really, really interesting to listen to. I think equally important is the fact that they didn't show any clips of him defensively. But, you know, that segment would have been, here's what he's good at going forward, but here's why he's an attacker trying to be played at right wing back, if he could have shown some clips of him struggling defensively. But the fact is, there isn't any clips of him struggling defensively to show. So he's done very, very well, really well. I think he has massive potential in that role. I do. I think he's got massive potential in that role. I think if we were playing with a system with wing backs, I think Seamus is now too old to play as a wing back, in my opinion. I think he could play on right in the back three still, absolutely. Matt Doherty, you know, does Matt just go across to the left and play left wing back, or does he just find himself out of the side altogether? You'd do really, really well to put forward an argument at this stage that Matt Doherty is just straight out a better pick at right wing back than Chidozie Egbene. I don't know how really too many people could make that argument. So look, if it's a manager who goes with three centre halves, I think it really, really would have to be considered. It's just like, you know, again, complete hyperbole and all that, but it did the performance. Those clips in particular would absolutely remind you of the Gareth Bale heyday. You know, now fair enough, he's doing it to Dan Byrne rather than Maicon, but still, it was very resemblant of it. The way just the pace is blistering. I remember the last time I came up against him, David. I was Galway manager, and I came up with a scheme of I played Colm Horgan, who was my right back. At right midfield. I then played a right back at right back. And then I played a holding midfielder who I told, instead of staying central, play kind of 5 yards to your right. So we essentially tried to box him in with a triangle of three players that were pretty much focused on one. And the bet is 3-2 and he still fucking scored.
And he played in the opposite flank and he was like, who's that with that side?
No, well, that is interesting, actually, because back then he was on the opposite flank. So that was he was playing left wing back then. So he was, because he was brilliant at driving infield because of the pace and coming inside and scoring, where now, obviously, in that role with Luke, it's going down the outside. But no, he's flying. Now, look, again, you know, you look how highly we speak of Evan Ferguson, and now Evan Ferguson has found himself, you know, struggling for game time at the moment. Like, it is only a month ago since Benny, you know, was kind of in and out of the side. He's only really starting to make himself nailed on now, which is great.
And that could be fair. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think there were definitely cases of managing him with injury, or I'm not sure what there was definitely an issue there where they're managing sort of his minutes, but also then just obviously learning the role. Even the clips that they were showing, obviously the pace, even watching that game on Saturday against Newcastle, and like, his pace did stand out, but even just little things of just how proactive he was in everything he was doing and aggressive in what he was doing in that game. But then also, as they were showing, just how switched on he was being in terms of the timings of his runs and when he was making them, but then also when he was choosing the support and how he was doing it. It wasn't just get it, knock it past and try and rinse and repeat that. You know what I mean? He was like, he was causing issues because he was doing different things and was able to mix it up. And that's maybe that's another element to it of that was needed this year as well, where he needed to actually go and look at that. Because when they signed him, he was one of the first players they signed. And it was obviously Rob Edwards, the Luton manager. They've been very clever with the recruitment, and they've, like, obviously Ross Barkley as well is just, I don't think anybody is seeing this kind of coming with him in this stage of his career, because when he went over to France, it just seemed as if he was dwindling. But they've gone in and wanted fellas who are hungry to learn. Now, there's the difference between having that hunger to learn and then the actual capability to take it on, Gav, and actually be at the level, realise what's required, and then be able to improve.
He's just such an intelligent footballer as well. Like, he's obviously got the physical and the technical gifts to play at that level, but it's just his brain really sets him aside as well, I think. And he must be a manager's dream, because he solves so many problems for him. You know, he's so adaptable. Like, he has played off the left this season as well. You remember giving Trent Alexander-Arnold an absolute chasing in the league game at home to Liverpool. Has looked better now off the right, in fairness, to that right wing back role. And it's his recovery pace, but obviously his kind of diligence in doing it and his intelligence positioning wise is really great for Luton, because what's happened in the last couple of weeks with Luton is that Rob Edwards has realised, actually, we just need to go for games. Like, they've become less defensive and more attacking as the season has gone on. And like, there are times in that game against Newcastle where they were leaving 3v3 at the back, you know, and that's a team with, you know, Anthony Gordon, okay, ended up playing as a false nine and then had to come off at half time. They've Almiron, they've Wilson, they had real pace up front. Harvey Barnes then came on as well, but they're able to go 3v3 because Ogbene has the engine to get back, has the pace to get, has to do it quickly. And it's just the intelligence to know when to do it and the right positions to take up, and also playing him a right wing back as well. Like, I mean, you give him his speed, he's so fast. Like, and like, he's not just got that short burst of speed. He's quick off the mark, but then he seems to has that kind of Martinelli ability of, you start off fast, but you keep on getting faster, you know, whereas a lot of players have a short burst of speed and then they start slowing up over long distances. So starting him at right wing back gives you, you know, allows you to run from deep. And, you know, poor old Dan Byrne. Now, I have to say, when Carragher was, I know Carragher compared Ogbene to Henri, and I kind of used that headline for the site today, but thinking about it again, I thought maybe it was more of a case of Carragher comparing himself to Dan Byrne than it was the other way around. But no, sure, it's, look, what a great story, you know? And like, that's one of the reasons, the real reasons for optimism. And yeah, over the last couple of years, obviously for Ireland, results have been fairly miserable and not much has been achieved. But his emergence is primarily down to him, but also something that Stephen Kenny and the Irish setup should take great credit for.
Well, that's it, because he was a standout player in 2023 for Ireland in terms of True Evan. He was the one who you still thought, right, well, that's the positive mark there. And like, realistically, if you're looking at it, he's going to be the one that's going to be Ireland's best chance of getting up a pitch in games and creating something. And like you touched on it, mentioned him earlier, with Evan Ferguson, it's going to be, you would imagine, Ogbene being the chief supply of goals with the attributes that he has. And then contrast and say Ogbene's kind of emergence and the pathway he took with, say, Alameda, because I had this piece up on the site this morning on the back of his long move himself, just doing a bit of ringing around and stuff. And like he's obviously, he's 23 on Sunday. He's still someone who will have a future, I think, definitely. Like, he's got all the attributes. But even just listening, like, he obviously he's had a couple of injury issues, but the fact that he's 5 years now senior football and hasn't played 5 consecutive games of 90 minutes, which just
unreal.
Which just says a lot, and it kind of just plays into what we've all been saying over the last while, even when Evan Ferguson was breaking through. You want to just, obviously you want to see them be able to score goals, but you want to just see them have that level of consistency where they're in the team and they're able to play and get use to their body. I know Chris Sutton had a bit of a cut off him, and we're having this point, but like, unless you're able to play regular football in games, sometimes you don't know how to use your body in the right way. You don't know how to actually utilise the strengths you have. You know, and it was interesting that like Norwich were willing to obviously let him go to Sheffield Wednesday on loan, just keep him in the Championship, get him games. I think Stoke were in from Verona. That move was close, but they wanted an option to buy. And then eventually he was offered to Celtic, and Brendan Rodgers took him in a heartbeat. And then after training during the week, was just literally had him out doing one-on-one work with him, because he sees what he can have there. It's, I know obviously we say it was Celtic, and Liam Scales has come to the fore there as well, but that could be a big thing to look at for the next half of the season, is because if there's definitely a player there, we've seen it in kind of sporadic moments with Ireland. If he can have some form of just consistency between now and the end of the season, like again, I use the headline, it could be the making of him, hopefully, in terms of realising himself how best to use his own attributes.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, a big fan. And like, if you go back 2 or 3 years, you know, when we had the whole, say, Parrott, Connolly, Obafemi, Ida, all coming through at the one time, Parrott obviously that bit younger, but like Ida was the one, based on how much Stephen had used him with the 21s and how much faith he had in him, he was the one that I thought was going to be capable of stepping up first, almost. And because he's just, to me, he can do all of the parts of the game. He can play with his back to goal. He can score. And he's, you know, he's no slouch. He can, I'm not saying he's blisteringly fast, but he can run in behind. Absolutely, he can run in behind. So he's got a huge amount to his game. My concern is, and maybe with you doing that piece, you might be able to kind of answer or lessen my concerns here on this, is how, like, I don't understand how he's going to be a starter up there either. Is he not just gone to another club where he's not going to be a starter?
That was obviously part of the conversation. I'll be honest, I don't know if he was given guarantees. Yeah, because he came off the bench. He didn't start against Aberdeen. He came off the bench and set up a goal. Did he play? Is it they play Hibs tomorrow? Is it tomorrow they play Hibs and then they play in the cup against St Mirren on Sunday? So maybe, I don't know, like, if that could be this, the Sunday could be the game he can start. But this is what I'm saying, it's basically how it was laid out, was like, maybe you come through an environment at a club like Norwich, like or any club when you've come over as a kid and you're viewed as that academy kind of prospect, and you just got off this thing. You only got signed a 5-year contract last year. Do you know what I mean? Like they still see him as someone who they want to hopefully fulfill his potential. But there is that, definitely that sense of going into a different environment and actually having a different kind of pressure and trying to play games and try and score goals. So, like, I know what you mean. I don't, it's not as if he's gone there and you can say, right, well, it's clear they've got him because he is head and shoulders above that Celtic have got there, and even the system that Celtic play, I don't know, like, but...
Well, that's my point, is, like, you know, I've only really seen Celtic play with one out and out up top. I'm just looking at the substitutions here, actually. I must try and get on and try and see if I can get some footage from that game on Saturday, because, like, he came on for Bernardo, who's a midfielder. Yeah. So I don't know. Did they switch to just a straightforward 4-4-2? I just, like, Kyogo doesn't get taken off. Like, he doesn't get taken off. He starts and finishes almost every game, and he's, you know, he's Celtic's best player. So that, like, that's, I'm just looking at that scenario and I'm going, well, how does Ida get in the team here? Like, how does he even get minutes? Yeah. if Kyogo comes off fairly rarely, because I would think that if he can get minutes, I do think he'll do very well.
I think that's the gamble. I'm
not sure where those minutes come from.
I think that's what they are kind of just weighing up, or what he was weighing up, in terms of, it was a move that, like, right, go work under someone like Brendan Rodgers in terms of having that influence there, but then going and... Now, listen, it could work out where maybe some of the other issues that have happened in the past, where maybe where injury or just not being able to do it, and it's the same issue that you had at Norwich, but I think it's that sense of, right, go out and actually, as it was put me, get out of that bubble a little bit of Norwich, where it can be almost like a protective element to it, and go into an environment where you have to go and deliver and see what you're made of. Like, it's literally a case of go and show what you're actually capable of doing, proving that you're able to do it. You know?
The funny thing about Ida is that you look at him and he's kind of got all the skills and characteristics of a guy who can lead the line by himself, like the number 9 in a 4-3-3. He's always looked best in the front two, to be honest. I know, apart from that aforementioned Greece game, but his best spell in the Premier League was when, you know, he scored his first goal. Was it against Everton, playing in a front two with Pookie? He's just always looked better with the front man up top. So maybe, you know, Brendan Rodgers has proved himself in the past to be happy to change formations and approaches and so forth, depending on who he's got. He's not nearly as idealistic as he says he is in his interviews. So maybe, you know, maybe he can make that kind of impression to force that kind of change at Celtic and get more goals into the team, which would be great. And just the big disappointment is that he hasn't forced his way into the Norwich team, because, you know, as you say, Dave, 5-year deal. Pookie left. Ida talked about that. As soon as Pookie left, he thought, okay, this is my chance now to become the main man here. And was it Ashley Barnes that recruited, and as a result has kind of struggled with Josh Sargent around as well. So, and it's interesting what you say, Dave, that there's no option to buy for Celtic. Like, Norwich are definitely going to take him back in the summer regardless of what happens.
Well, that's it, because he's like, I think everyone has seen it where he, and it's that it's the typical thing. He's, this is the thing, he's, he, as I said, he's going to be 23, but like, he's not like a teenager, but yet, again, I'm kind of repeating, but it's kind of getting that sense of that's how the prism he's kind of still viewed through, maybe a little bit of knowledge when you come through an academy, and maybe you're not kind of looked upon maybe as the same as, say, a player brought in for big money or brought in from the outside, because he brought in as a Sydney Van Hooydonk, Pierre Van Hooydonk's son on loan as well. But like Norwich have, but I don't know, I just hope it's one of those where you're just hoping that it's something that he takes from it, because he's not, if he goes there, hits the ground running, like I said, except they're going to title race here as well, like it's not as if he's going to be going there and it's going to be like Brendan, like I know he had the anecdote in the piece about Brendan Rodgers doing a bit of one-on-one work with him, but like that's not going to be a regular feature, you would imagine. He's not gone there as a kind of a favour and a pet project from like Rodgers. He has other things in mind. He has to try and win that league because they're in a proper kind of title race there, you know, and that being in that environment is a bit different as well as what you're hoping for. Is like we've referenced it about Benny, is like you want to see players when you have these challenges hopefully be able to be capable of having the mental ability and also the playing ability to be actually able to rise them, and there's no getting away from it. That's still the question mark that's around them, because the talent and the attributes are clear, you know. And from one title race to another, City looked impressive. I would laugh for a while. And the goal against Brentford did come a bit out of the blue, but against someone to play. But then Phil Foden, hat trick, De Bruyne back, Haaland back, Liverpool losing, Arsenal taking photos. I don't know. There's just another sense of very ominous of what's going to happen.
City have zero injuries at the moment, which is kind of crazy when you look at how
Stones are injured.
Stones on the bench last night.
Oh, was he?
Guardiola said ahead of the game, they've literally no one injured. It's crazy, you know. So now they've obviously got De Bruyne and Haaland back, and De Bruyne is making absolutely huge impact. He's something. Stat last night on the TV, he's like had 34 assists since the start of last season, like 9 clear of anyone else, and he's missed almost all of this season, which just goes to show partly, you know, who he's loading the bullets for, but like what one influential player he is. Like, look, you know, the Arsenal...
That's Jack Byrne kind of numbers there, Gav. Missed most of the season and still finished miles ahead of everyone else.
You know, Arsenal-Liverpool is the perfect result for the title race in a sense, because, oh, is this a three-way fight now, but are Man City going to come along and ruin the fun? You know, it's a 9th successive win now in all competitions, so you get the sense that, you know, based off past history, maybe they are just going to stride clear. But they also have a couple of flaws that, you know, we haven't seen previously. Like, they don't really keep clean sheets at all anymore, you know. And I think they've got a fairly handy run of fixtures up until March, where the Champions League comes back, and then, you know, they've got Liverpool and they've got Arsenal and a couple of more difficult games. So the Liverpool and Arsenal's hope is that they just keep winning themselves, and then they have to land the punches on City when they get the chance to throw them. But although Brentford also did pretty well for a lot of that game, you know, they've gave away some dumb goals in the end, particularly that first one, but they caused City some real problems and could easily have equalised a 2-2 even, but the great Diaz block from, was it Norgaard? But City, you know, I wouldn't say City were absolutely amazing, but they got the results, and, you know, it just feels ominous in the context of what's gone on before, less than what they've shown in the last few weeks.
Bring it on. I hope they kick on from here now, all going well. I'm not ethical enough to give a shit where all their money comes from. All I care about is the fact that I'm surrounded by Liverpool fans, and my godson is an Arsenal fan. So long as it's City and neither of those two teams, I'm happy enough. But like it was an odd game, like 15 shots on target. You know, there should only be one winner based on that kind of stat, and yet the Opta stat of big chances, which is like a chance that has over 0.5 XG or something, it's 3-3. Like Brentford had 3 proper goal scoring chances. So it was a strange kind of game in that sense. Surprised Pep managed to come up with a system that fit all of the attacking players essentially into the one team. Obviously, look, it still means Grealish and Doku missing out, but, you know, when you're looking at it there, you were saying, okay, so it's impossible for Haaland, Foden, Alvarez and De Bruyne all to start in one team. It happened. He did manage to start them all in one team. Whether it was cohesive as he would like it to be, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see what he does with it going forward. Like, it's like you kind of feel for Alvarez in that it's like he's been so good, and yet how does he stay in the team? How the hell does he stay in the team? Because De Bruyne is their best 10 and Haaland is their best 9. And now he was still kind of in that 10 role last night because De Bruyne pretty much played 8, really, more so than 10, if that makes sense, almost. Foden getting shoved out wide, you know, people were saying that was going to lessen his impact. Didn't seem to have that effect last night.
He played pretty central last night, Foden, in fairness. Like, all those three goals are because he's in very central attacking areas. And like you say, if Guardiola fixes the problem of how do you get... Because if De Bruyne and Haaland are the team, previously Foden's been kind of had to go wide and it's lessened his impact. So if he's, like you say, has found a way to get those three guys in the team and in reasonably central areas, De Bruyne had a pretty kind of a free role drifting out wide at times. That's a pretty scary prospect. But at the same time, then they were so vulnerable, especially down their left, you know, like, I mean, those little combinations involving the wing back down the right, even down the left sometimes with Reguilón, was quite a successful route to goal, really, for Brentford. So maybe it's not replicable against elite teams, but then City are going to have, what, two, maybe three, if you include Spurs, include three games against elite teams in the running.
Yeah, well, I mean, he did. There's no doubt he did change the system around last night. Like, he, for most of the season, he had gone where the width had to come from the two, you know, sideline hugging wingers were the ones supposed to be providing the width, whereas it was Vardiol was the one supplying the width high in the left-hand side yesterday, which shows tremendous adaptability from him. The fact that, you know, we saw him at the World Cup as a left-sided centre-half. He's now, you know, playing high up in the final third of the field on the left-hand side for the majority of the game. But that obviously then had the knock-on effect of allowing Foden to come in. So you've got, like, how do you deal with it? Like, my God, you've got, in the width of the 18-yard box, in those little pockets where there used to be one player in there, you've now got Foden, De Bruyne and Alvarez all popping up in those little pockets from various time to time. Bernardo Silva even coming in there sometimes. You know, it is when they get it right, it is fantastic to see. And the old one of how long can you say a player is underrated, but Rodri to me is in the top five players in world football. He's in the top five players of world football. And I think he gets credit, but I don't think too many would say that about him. Like, he's just absolutely outstanding.
Well, that's probably the reasons why City do play, or are able to play the players in front of him like that. Why Guardiola would consider even doing it. It's because he's the one.
But like, I mean, Rodri's like a high-end Steve Finnan now, Shane, in the sense that people have said he's underrated for so long that he has to be at this point rated. But just to go back to your point there about, like, how do you deal with all those players, like centre attacking players? People are also shitting themselves at the prospect of them. I think that's what happened on the first goal, is that there's a deep cross. Pinnock, I mean, that ball is just going out over the end line for a goal kick. Like, there's no one behind him. He should just let it go. But he's obviously thinks, fuck, Haaland is, that's the ball to the back post. Haaland is definitely there. He's always there. I just have to get something on this to get it away from him. And ultimately, it fell really well for Foden. But just briefly on Brentford, I actually thought Collins played pretty well. He's had a pretty rough time in a few games lately. I think the Spurs game was a challenging one for him, and obviously that night personal nightmare against Wolves in the league. Okay, maybe could have done better on Foden's hat-trick goal. Wasn't it the one that he just kind of stopped running? I don't know why he did that, but broadly I think he did pretty well. And one great moment of the first half where he was able to match Haaland stride for stride and block his first time shot in the penalty area. So,
and actually, your mention, Gav, of Irish centre halves actually brings me back to the Carragher segment. I was really surprised. Did you see when he put up the graphic of the fastest players? Dara O'Shea, fifth fastest speed clocked in the Premier League this year. I would never have guessed that. Fair play to him. That was brilliant to see.
Yeah, but was that getting off the pitch and getting hammered?
You're very hard on him there now. Very hard.
No, I know. That was criminal. No, it was more so. That was just the Burnley of, I'm probably going to get relegated already.
It's looking like it, unfortunately.
I am looking forward to it, though, when City play Everton. You can make your own financial fair play jokes this weekend, because you can just imagine what the Everton fans are going to have planned.
It's gonna be, could have some interesting banners, all right.
Yeah, well, Carrot, you know, it's going to be good fun. I know what else going to be good fun. President's Cup.
We're back. Yeah, you're going. You're looking forward to it.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward. I haven't been to Tallaght Stadium since the new stand has been completed. Pats have sold out. their allocation. I think it's going to be the guts of 3,000 Pats fans there. It's going to be, I think there could be over 7,000 at the match, you know. It's just kind of ball as well. And even around the league, it was looking like Galway have had record season ticket sales this year as well, coming back up to the Premier as well. But just, and obviously the league launches. The league launches tomorrow in Vicar Street.
League launches tomorrow, yeah.
I was trying to suss out with them if it was going to be one of Damien's MC gigs on, if you're going to kind of, I want to make sure to definitely be there. But you're going to be going along for that as well. Looking forward to that.
It's on a Vicar Street. Yeah, no, for sure. I was just going to say, like, I mean, Pats surely need a few spots in the stand for all these signings that they're making. I mean, there seems to be, you know, we're in the Pats Media WhatsApp group and Jamie Moore sending new signings in seemingly every day. You know, it's a huge squad.
A few have gone. A few important players have gone as well. Should be.
So it is early, but like, what's your Pats vibe? You know, I mean, is this the... Because it's not obvious who Rovers' close challengers are, to be honest, if it's Derry or Pats.
This is the thing. I don't know. I would still, if you look at it, like, Derry have only added two players because Rory Higgins has only wanted, felt as if they even needed two, but it's more so being two players we feel can make the biggest difference, and that's obviously Pat Hooban and Daniel Kelly. Like, they're, but then I saw it today as well. Was it the report that Diallo's going to miss the first maybe 2 months of the season, possibly, or about six or seven? He is. I think he had a bad injury in one of the most recent friendlies. So that could be a bit of a blow. I would still, just because of the nature of some of the players who Pats have lost. You know, obviously Sam Corse is gone, Morphy's gone. Who else is gone? Obviously, well, like, Norman's gone. He had a strong end to the half. Jay McGrath's gone. Tommy Lonergan. Again, strong enough end of the season. He's gone, but it's a decent option. And you don't know how some of the lads they've brought in will adapt. So I don't really know. That's the thing. You don't know, which I guess it kind of feels as if Pats have had a bit more upheaval than Derry. And then Rovers look strong. They've pretty much kept hold of who they wanted. They kept hold of, and they've added a couple of players as well. I'm just looking forward to getting back and going to football matches. I'm not going to lie. Just getting out and... Not so much getting out of the house, because I'm not like Greg Wallace. I like spending time with my kids. Don't know if you saw that on X. His perfect Sunday, you know. Anyway, sorry, I digress on that. But yeah, no, I'm just looking forward. Just looking forward to going. You're saying about vibes. I'm going to be interviewing Jamie Lennon later on. Probably feel that might I don't know, what's the word?
One of my favourite players in the League of Ireland. I always have a soft spot for sixes, and he's just brilliant in that role. Yeah. I love him.
I think this could be a big season for him. That's why I wanted to chat to him. I think this could be a big old year for him, you know. And I don't know too much. Being around the league for so long now, you forget, but like, I don't know too much about him as a person, you know. I know he was in Maynooth. He came through the scholarship programme that Pats had. And stuff, so just going to see that might see how he's feeling, see what message he gets across, because even when you're saying about he's one of your favourite players, but like, even Chris Forrest made the point about him, he just obviously he's unassuming, but you kind of wonder, like, can sometimes that hold a player back, you know, that maybe he doesn't seem to like maybe understand how good he can be or what he can do, you know. You kind of, that's why I'm kind of thinking, could this be a big enough year for him, because he's one of the most experienced players now in that squad, you know, which just makes me feel old.
Yeah. What age is he?
I'll have a look now. I think he's 26. Like,
jeez, that is making me feel old.
Like, yeah. He's been around.
If you'd asked me to have a stab at that now, absolutely, I would have said 23, 24 max.
Yeah. He's 25. He's 26 in May.
Okay, yeah, well, you're pretty much right then, yeah. You know? Yeah.
But just one of those.
Yeah, probably is. It's time for him so to kick on. Like, you know, he's been a really, really good player, really, but I would have still had him in that category of player who has a huge amount of potential to fulfill. But, you know, 26, you want to be fucking fulfilling it by that stage, so it's going to be a big season for him.
Well, listen, next week we're going to be having our season preview, so we can save Shane's top tips for then he'll to watch out. we'll have obviously some reaction and a bit of chat from that league launch as well. I'll try and get some audio from Jamie Lennon to yours too, and just excitement of a new season and live football, and yeah, talking rubbish here now. I think that we call it a day there, lads, Libby.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
No worries, good to see us. Take care, enjoy the rest of your week. Until next week.
Cheers, guys.
Good luck.